I wanted to talk a little bit this morning about, and this will be a little bit tricky for those of you who aren't here as often, so I'm sorry for that, but a little bit about what I say at the very beginning of the service, sort of the welcoming announcements, or the sort of preliminary introduction to the service. And what I did this morning is a little different than what I do sometimes. But for those of you with reasonable memories, what are some of the things I usually say in that bit? Which books and pages to use? Numbers. I talk about what numbers.
All the material that we received.
I talk about what you got when you came in the door. We don't all have to do the same thing.
Welcome.
Mm?
Welcome.
Welcome. I tell the truth. I'm truly glad to see everyone who's here this morning. So here's the trickier question, because I think that's most of the things. Welcome people. I tell them I'm glad to see you. I talk about the things you got when you came in the door, the books and page numbers and sort of hopefully a brief overview of things that will help you get through the service. Why do I do that? To help people feel comfortable. Yeah, that's part of it. Okay, two people are talking at once, so this person first.
If there are new people, to help orient them to the way that things here.
That's part of it, too. So if there are new people, so they're a little more oriented to, because we do a lot of stuff in a day of worship, even when it's not Palm Sunday.
To help get us organized.
It's a little bit to make sure we all have the things we need. Our sides people are usually very on top of things, but every now and then, especially if you've come in a little bit later, you might want to move closer to someone who has the one thing you didn't get, if it's a particularly important thing. So here's the sneaky reason I also do it. I do it so those of you who are here most weeks, some of you are here almost every week, but most of the time now, people come most weeks, know these things, so when you see someone who isn't here most weeks, you know these things and you can turn around and help them. Because no matter how much I tell you, there's always that thing a newcomer or someone who isn't here quite as often may not know. Or maybe it's just a little hard to find the right page in the prayer book, and you're going to be half a second faster than a newcomer. And you can find the page and turn around and share a book a little bit faster. Or they're going to be sitting there going, oh, something just changed. And you can help them through that. So part of the reason I do it is so those of you who really know it maybe a little better, I'm hoping, than you've let on this right now, do know it. And when you see someone struggling a bit, you go, oh, wait, I know what this moment is. And you're on top of it to help people around you. And you know what the big secret here is? I see you guys doing this. When we have visitors and when you see them struggling to find the right hymn or struggling to find the right page, I do see you turning around and saying, oh, I have that page and I know what I'm doing, so why don't we trade books? You have my book and I'll take yours because I know this well enough, I can find the page and a little bit of fumbling isn't going to throw me off. Because the truth is, there's one of me, and no matter how many instructions I give, I can't get everyone onto the same page unless I were to go around and like open everyone's book for them. And that would take a really long time, and it would be kind of insulting to a lot of people. We wouldn't get many people who would stay if I was doing that. But if you're turning around and you're saying, oh, I can help you with that, That's really inviting and welcoming in a way that's hard to describe unless you've ever been in a church where you've needed that. And someone has just turned around and said, oh, I can help you. Has anyone ever been in that position? I have. That's an act of kindness, isn't it? So part of the reason I do that whole spiel in the beginning is actually for those of us who are here every week. So we know all of those things really well. Weird, huh? Sometimes I'm really sneaky. Sometimes I even tell you that I'm really sneaky like that. Thank you. And thank you for all of the times you've been really kind and you've turned around and you've helped people who look like they were struggling. When visitors come, you guys are often the reason they come back, not me. So thank you for that. Poor Peter. I mean, Peter gets made fun of a lot. If any of you have ever spent a lot of time studying English and literature, you may know he's sort of the foil. Jesus gets things right and Peter gets things wrong. But today is something more. Peter denies Jesus. He does it multiple times. He does it after telling Jesus he won't, even if he has to die. He does it after promising he won't even desert Jesus. He does it after that whole falling asleep bit. After all of that, when put on the spot, Peter still says, I don't know him. That guy? I don't know what you're talking about. No, I swear, I don't know him. You're crazy. This is something more than being too eager to answer the question and getting it wrong. This is something more than not understanding that Jesus is shifting the way religion happens. It's trying to tug the disciples into a new sort of relationship with God. This is something deeper and darker. If you want a fancy word for it, the word would be apostasy, which comes up often, if you read early church history, the renunciation of faith, an apostate, someone who forsakes their faith. Maybe that's what Peter does here, maybe not. I'm sure somewhere scholars have debated that. But this is undoubtedly Peter's low point. Can you imagine when he hears the cock crow the second time? He remembers Jesus' words, what it must have felt like in the pit of his stomach. I bet right after remembering Jesus' words, he remembers his own promise, that he had just done the one thing he promised he would never do, the point of his own death. And here he was alive. And he stays alive. Judas doesn't. Judas, who betrays Jesus, is so torn up by his betrayal that he kills himself. If you come the Sunday after Easter, you'll hear this great story. It's one of the resurrection appearances where Jesus and Peter have this meeting. And Jesus turns to Peter and asks him repeatedly if Peter loves Jesus. Judas never gets that sort of chance. You have to wonder, or at least I have spent some time wondering this week, what sort of strength it took for Peter to get to that moment on that beach with Jesus. He had broken his word. For all of the jokes, and some of them are quite good, and all of the fun we have about Peter, for all of the love we have about all of Peter's follies, what we know about all of the mistakes Peter makes is he makes them out of this earnest desire to try and get it right. He's not the class clown. He really wants to do what Jesus wants him to do. It's just really hard to do that. And he's willing to try. He tries again and again and again. Tonight isn't him trying in the courtyard. Tonight is him scared and alone, surrounded by people who would, in fact, likely be willing to kill him. Tonight is something different. Peter, desperate. But I think out of this may come the greatest lesson Peter has to teach us. So if we look at the totality of Jesus and Peter's relationship, what we see is something that must have been so complicated. And complicated can be good. Complicated gives you layers and depths. What we don't get in the Gospels is all of the late night conversations they must have had each time Peter got it wrong. And that would have been a lot of late night conversations. Okay, Jesus, tell me why I got it wrong this time. And you can, you know, sit there and try and imagine Peter's mind with all of the gears trying to work through why that time wasn't right either. And trying again in another late night conversation with all of the gears, trying to wrap his mind around this teacher he adored, this person who is also God, who is here to love him and to change the world, who wanted him to do something that was so hard and so simple, all at the same time. Maybe it was the strength of all of those conversations that get Peter from this moment of realization in the dark at the sound of that cock crowing onto the beach with Jesus later. The knowledge that messing up doesn't ruin your faith. The knowledge that sometimes it's the point where you can come back, where things can be messy and complicated, that is in fact the act of faith itself. That you can stand in the dark and feel alone and say the words you never thought would come out of your mouth because they horrify you, and you wish you could take them back as soon as you had said them, except maybe you also mean them in this moment. And you can still turn and talk to the God who loves you. And in the moment of turning is the moment your faith is real. No matter how many times it has to happen, no matter what your history of making those mistakes looks like or feels like some days, there's always another conversation on another beach, and another moment where Jesus will ask you a question Jesus already knows the answer to. Do you love me? Yes, even when I get it wrong. Yes, even when it's too hard to realize. Yes, even when I feel alone. I imagine Peter alone in that courtyard, even though he was surrounded by people. People who didn't understand. People who needed to know what he knew. Saying words he didn't want to say, even though he might believe them in that moment. And I think we've all been there. I wonder if we have judged ourselves too harshly for those moments. Peter denies Jesus. There is no getting around that. There are plenty of moments of denial, probably in our futures. The question, though, is not if those will happen. The question for us is how many moments of turning back to God, how many moments of faith like that are there in our futures? Amen.